Welcome to the Ecology and Research Channel. Green issues, ecology, incredibly important to embodiment. Obviously, we're embodied in place, we're embodied in a world. How we treat ourselves is how we treat the planet and vice versa. So this is super important, I think, for our whole planet. Research relates to this. We've sort of put two together there. We didn't quite know where to put research, so we put them in with ecology. This stage has lots of great speakers, people I personally enjoy, and it's sponsored by Forests Without Frontiers. So rather than sell a sponsorship for this channel, we decided, you know what, let's give it away to a green charity. Tree planting seemed a good one. We thought we can all get behind that. We all breathe air. We looked into a load, actually. Some of them are quite famous, but don't actually plant a lot of trees, weirdly, or other things aren't so good with them. This one, Forests Without Frontiers, really does the work. They're in charge of a really big reforestation project in Central Europe, but, you know, we're all breathing it, thank you. It's run by Nicoletta, a very cool lady, and just a cool organization that really does the work. The money goes, you know, efficiently to actually planting trees. I'm happy to be supporting them. For me, it was like, you know, when we were looking at our charities to support, a green one just made a lot of sense to me. That just was obvious. Please do support them. Links below. As well as that, enjoy the whole channel. There's so much richness in this topic.
And welcome, Professor Glenn Mazis, with his presentation today on the worlds of non-objectified bodies. Glenn is a professor of philosophy and humanities, a Merleau-Ponty scholar, and the occasional poet. He's written 7 books, five philosophy books and 2 poetry books, and he's published 75 poems in 39 literary journals, and now works at Penn State Harrisburg. So welcome, Glenn.
Thank you. Thank you very much. This is so much fun. I loved doing this last year and talking to people around the world. And I'm aware that I only have a half hour around a half hour I want to speak, because then I that's how I taught for all those years. I believe in discussion, but I just want to set the scene first. And so I'll take about a half hour to talk about the body, because I don't think culturally and in the history of philosophy as it was understood from the Greeks to the Europeans to the Americans and in some other traditions too, that the body is not really understood, which is very bizarre since we are bodies. And the world that you see through the body, I don't think is well understood. So, okay, this is what I'm gonna do. I decided I'd do a very quick couple biographical facts about me, because they show where I'm coming from in terms of the body. Then I'm going to read a poem or two, because my newest book is a whole book of poems about the body. And then I'm just going to talk about the body. And I was going to do a few exercises, but my wife said, come on, Glenn, you know, your real talent is explaining the body in a different way. So I'm going to hold the exercises for the last thing that is asked here, which is to give some tips to people how to put into practice what I'm saying. And so I'll describe them at the very end, but I don't think we'll actually get to do them together. Okay, so I'm gonna start. The worlds of the body and the body kind of understood in a different way. So I was around 18, and actually I wanted to be a biologist, and I was into science, and was, you know, my father was an engineer and kind of looked at things in probably a mechanical way. And then I just found this weird philosophy that I got enamored with called phenomenology. And it's a way of, it's kind of a rebellion against all of traditional philosophy, saying it's not about thinking about things and categorizing things and explaining them, you know. It's more about really looking at things and describing them and expressing them, because expression is something you're involved in. It takes into account your felt experience and you're communicating it to others. So that was one thing that happened to me. Then three things happened to me when I was 18. Then I fell into a group of Zen Buddhists and started meditating every day. And I've been doing it pretty much since, doing Zazen my whole life. And the Buddhists started saying the same thing, like, you know, you don't really know what you're experiencing because so much is going on in your mind that you're not really in touch with your perceptions and your body. Instead, you have to clean the mirror of your perceptions, is the way the Buddhists put it. And then they said you would really start to feel and to connect with things in a different way. And so that was kind of interesting because it really fit the philosophy I was being exposed to. And then at the same time, I started getting involved in Gestalt therapy and trained for a while as a Gestalt therapist. And all I'll say is the motto of Gestalt therapy, which was started by Fritz Perls, and I could say things about all these things later if you ask me questions, is that awareness itself is curative. That, you know, just becoming more aware resolves so many of our problems. And the Buddhists, you know, put it that we're locked into hell worlds until we clean this mirror. And I'm going to talk about that later too. I tended earlier in my life just to talk, give the good news about embodiment. But I want to also talk about how is it that we fall into such painful places with our bodies, and how is it that it is so hard sometimes to really open yourself to the body. So I'll get to that later. The last thing I'll say by way of introduction is, though, that when I became a philosopher, as Mike mentioned, Merleau-Ponty sort of became my guru. And, you know, he was this philosopher who really concentrated on the body in a way no other philosopher had up until that point. And as only the French would, after World War II, he was on popular radio. They had a Saturday afternoon, they would take philosophers and give them 2 hours. And he was on for 7 hours in a row, 7 weeks in a row for 14 hours. And this is the one reference I'll give you. If you want to like introduction to what I'm saying today, they finally translated those little lectures that he made on the radio. And it's called The World of Perception. And I think that's a great title, but don't read the introduction, by the way. The introduction is written by a philosopher who doesn't understand Merleau-Ponty. But anyhow, The World of Perception, I think, is a good title because that was his point. He said, there's a different world if you really get in touch with your body, and that our cultural tradition is really out of touch with that world. So I'm going to explain all this in a couple minutes. But first, I used to do this when I was young, and I got out of the habit of doing it, but I'm going to do it again, which is an invocation to the muse to read two poems. One is a little more dense poem. They're both from my new book, The Body is a Dancing Star, which is with Orchard Street Press, to give myself a little commercial. One's a denser one and one's a very straightforward one. The denser, more poetically imaginative one says, and it's called The True Dimensions of the Body, says, an arm and a galaxy might begin to make a body, or the cinders of old volcanoes might become the soles of our feet if the embers still glow. Our bodies stretch so far, we need to add a dimension to the map of the world where they might live and lie seated in together like the juicy insides of pomegranates. The ear awakens each day to the sound of the silent Buddha sitting under the bow tree. And within this soft flesh, everything else sounds a note, rings the resonating bell that sits on the brightly colored circular pillow of the whole body. A back and a mountain might reach up to the shoulders of the clouds that cross the sky, offering our minds a path to slip down towards the end and rest our heavy loads on those blue stretched sinews. We can then bend down from these concerned heights to lie across the earth and sleep quietly in the fold of the arm that cradles. And before I read the much shorter and more straightforward poem. I mean, that's really the theme of my talk, is that we can't do ecology justice until we see the world through the body. Because when we see the world through the body and experience it through the body, then we experience our interconnection with everything. And when we do that, then the stakes, the ecological stakes, are so different, because our very being depends upon everything around us. And we start to feel compassion in a different way. Okay, but my second poem, and this is a much shorter and straightforward one, The Body Is, that's the title. The body so often goes unnoticed, with its trillions of little workers working in purring perfection, like the bees in a hive. And it too feeds me the honey I taste each day, allowing me to still be here among the purple petunias, with my dogs licking my legs as they fly across the yard and onto my chair. And below me, my wife reaches down, shapely body, suddenly in front of my ravished eyes, and kisses me quietly. The body gives me a place to be among all these things, those for whom I awake in the morning with a start, as I slip into the overgrown woods by the path, following the Susquehanna lazily along, and later the smell of the morning coffee slides into me with a comforting hand of greeting, as my wife's eyes open to a sky become green through the trees surrounding our window, reflected in her eyes where they have a home. So those are my two poems that kind of set the scene for what I want to say as a philosopher and somebody who's done a lot of Gestalt therapy and Zazen. So I wanted to say one thing about the history of philosophy and culture. I mean, I think you all know that, you know, there's a history going all the way back to Plato that, you know, European philosophers credit Alfred North Whitehead, an American philosopher, said all philosophy in the last 2,000 years is just a footnote to Plato. And Plato, you know, started that tradition by saying the body is a prison. And, you know, Socrates, when he was about to die, said, give a cock to Asclepius, which meant that he's the doctor, I'm cured, I'm leaving my body. And this is one of the most famous lines from Plato, from his Phaedo. Each pleasure and pain seems to have a nail, and nails the soul to the body, and pins it on and makes it bodily. And so it thinks the same things are true that the body thinks true. And it says, and then he continues, and I suppose it reasons best, the soul, when none of the senses disturb it, hearing or sight, pain or pleasure, but when it's completely by itself and says goodbye to the body. And he tells this tale, by the way, that the body nails us not just to any old earth, but this slimy, decaying earth versus the pure earth of mind. You know, so this was taken up by Christianity, and it was taken up by all the metaphysical philosophers in our tradition, in the European and Greek and American tradition, who kind of, and some other traditions too, which I could talk about later, you know, who dreamed of getting back, escaping the body and getting back to this realm of pure spirit. But I also want to point out one thing about our current time. You know, in America, there is almost a cult of the body, I would say, right now. Like, you know, people going to the gym crazily and, you know, all this cultivation of the body. And, you know, some people say, see, we've gotten past this hatred of the body. And I would say, no, it's the exact same thing. It's still seeing the body as an object, as something I somehow own or possess. And that's not the way that Merleau-Ponty or Buddhism or Gestalt or Mises is talking about the body. instead, you know, it's, as I said in the title, an unobjectified body. I was going to read you, I just because I said it so much better in the beginning of this book, I was just going to read you a couple sentences. At any moment, you are probably much more than you probably imagine yourself to be, because you are an earth body. An earth body isn't yours, it's the world's. Despite cultural biases, you don't have this body. You are part of a dynamic process that we might call earth bodying, if we weren't so used to referring to ourselves with nouns. Earth bodies are sensual, perceptual, feeling conductors through which richer meaning flows than we can grasp intellectually. The world to which I refer to here also is not properly a noun, but more a verb, a process. The currents moving through these bodies are dynamic processes. So I'm gonna stop there. I could keep reading. But I'm just gonna say one more thing here. We shape the world since it's indeterminate and fluctuating as it flows forth, but the world shapes us since we are also indeterminate and fluctuating as we flow forth. We are only a node in a vast field of energies and meanings. Perceiving is an art, and we can take the world in more or less gracefully, more or less expressively, and more or less sensitively. You know, we can't ever reach zero. I mean, we all have some of that artist in us, because then we would fail to thrive. We would fail to even be able to get through the day. But that's another thing that I think is so essential to really opening up to the body, is to see that everything is in time. You know, it's not out of time. I mean, that's another religious and metaphysical dream of getting to this realm beyond time. But time itself isn't just the instant. It's not broken up. And that's what I'll be talking about. Like, we've broken everything up into these little parts. And once you break Humpty Dumpty up, you can't put them back together in the right way. Whereas other traditions, the ones I mentioned, start with the whole, start with the gestalt. I mean, you're listening to me right now and you're not having to, like, your brain is not having to go, oh my God, he said that word and that word and that word and that word. How do I put it together to make a sentence? Just like a melody, ba-ba-ba-bum, ba-ba-ba-bum. You don't hear each note, you hear the melody. The same thing when I'm talking, but the same thing when you're perceiving also. Everything is part of a kind of duration, a continuity, a kind of flow of time that I'm going to talk about it later, that we can move around in that flow. We always do. Right now, while you're listening to my sentence, some of you are thinking of what happened last night, and you might have been so riveting that you're really more there than here, or you might be waiting for what's happening tonight. And we're always moving around in time. But I'll talk more about that in a moment, because I think it's important, once we really get into the body, to look at time again. If the world is not, oh, there's another perspective, by the way, that I want to throw in here that I teach a lot too, which is Native American philosophies, literatures, cultures. I mean, they're all, you know, different tribes are different, but I think one thing which you'll find across different Native American groups is this sense that the world is alive, it's not inert, and that we are part of it, and that we are interlocutors with it, that there's always a back and forth with the world, and that we're not somehow separate from it. And I was going to read one, I'm not going to keep reading, but there's one beautiful, beautiful paragraph I love from Leslie Marmon Silko's Ceremonies, one of my favorite books in the world, Ceremony. And Teo is a person that we're going to talk about in a little later. He's one of the people who's become closed off to the world because he's been so violated. He was on the Bataan Death March and tortured by the Japanese, and also has suffered horrible things as a child with his mother when they were homeless and looked down upon for being Native Americans. But the worst thing is he watches his beloved brother be crushed to death by the Japanese because he's too hurt and he's holding up the marching line. And so they just bayonet him. Well, they don't even bayonet him. They club him to death in front of Teo. And Teo closes off to the world. He closes off to his feelings and his perception, his body. But ceremony is about his coming back to the world. And here's one of the first times he's really open to the world. And he says he's in this back country and he comes across this pond and he's looking out over the pond. And this is the quote: "Dragonflies came and hovered over the pool. They were all the colors of blue, powdery sky blue, dark night blue, shimmering with almost black iridescent light, and mountain blue. There were stories about the dragonflies too. He turned. Everywhere he looked, he saw a world made of stories. The long ago, the time immemorial stories, as old grandma called them. It was a world alive, always changing and moving. And if you knew where to look, you could see it. Sometimes almost imperceptible, like the motion of the stars across the sky." To me, that kind of sensibility is the kind of sensibility that when we pull back and can't enter our bodies fully, as he says, we can't see that, it becomes invisible. But everything is moving and interconnected. And, it's embarrassing to me as a philosopher that the most famous sentence in European philosophy is, "I think, therefore I am," that individualistic view of things and that isolated view of things. Whereas I would say it's something like more like we feel, we perceive, and we are together with the world. And not just only animate things, but inanimate things. John Barth said that the key to the treasure is the treasure itself. And I think, so many cultures have always been looking someplace else for the answer. And the answer is right here. But I want to speak about coming back to the body too, in terms of perception. The senses are not distinguishable from our emotional attunement to the world. And again, we've understood emotions as these internal things, like something I feel in here. But I would like to say that emotion, the word itself means moving out from yourself and into the world. And the way Merleau-Ponty put it was, he said, perception is like a fission, that as you perceive, you are fissioned into the world. And he says, you only return to yourself at the end of that perception. And so I want to say that perception is this kind of spiraling back and forth with the world. And each time you change, and the world speaks to you. And what Merleau-Ponty, he quoted Malraux, said, there's voices of silence that the world gestures to us, just to like we gesture to each other all the time. That so much of our communication, and that's what I'm talking about this whole time, that the most vital sense of who we are and who others are is not the kind we process through our minds, but it's the kind we feel in an immediate embodied way, but what philosophers would call pre-reflectively. We come back to ourselves through this spiral and the world does speak to us. And there are times we notice it and times we don't. But I'll give two examples. Merleau-Ponty called this reversibility. But, you know, that it's not just us making sense of the world speaks back to us just as much, but cultures throughout history have found this to be the case. Like in the Native American philosophy book I often teach by Paula Gunn Allen, she doesn't thank her editor, she doesn't thank her publisher, she doesn't thank her family, she thanks the tumbleweeds and the sun and the mountains for speaking to her what she had to say in the book. And there's so many cultures in which that's not a strange thing to say. The fact that it's become a strange thing for too many of us is a problem. I want to say one more thing about Ledley Marmon Silko. So in the book ceremony, there's a witch contest, and the winner by far is the last witch, who is a sorcerer, who calls upon destructive forces. And what she does is, this witchery is a philosophy that the world is inert, that the world is dead, and that humans are in charge of that world. And she said, that's really what has caused all the damage in the world. Because once you see the world is inert and dead and you in charge, then you're no longer in a dialogue with it, and it becomes scary. I mean, it's hard to always be manipulating the world. You have to be on the defensive instead of being in a dialogue and working with the world. There's a lot of things in Western philosophy. I keep criticizing it, and I shouldn't, because there's been other voices, like, you know, Friedrich Nietzsche said to remain faithful to the earth and the body is the great reason. And, you know, Martin Heidegger said, you know, the idea is to let things be, to will to non-willing, to let yourself be released into things so they can talk back to us, that we can hear these voices of silence and see the gestures of the world. Now, I was going to read this, but I'm not going to, I've read too much and I don't have enough time. But in Nikos Kazantzakis's book, Zorba the Greek, Zorba gets up every morning and he rushes out to the rocks and the sea. And there's this one scene, he's with this European guy who can't make sense of what Zorba's about. And he sees a stone fall down the hill. And he says, my gosh, that stone is alive. I've never seen anything like that before. And the guy who's become his sidekick but doesn't really understand him says, that's what Zorba's like. He gets up every day and it's like he's seeing the world for the first time, like he's never seen it before. And he says, that's what great art is really about. That's what great humanity is really about. And it's very much like what Merleau-Ponty says too. He would say that we can all go back to that first day of our life, that it hasn't really fled. It's still there in the depths of perception. But it takes a kind of imagination. It takes a kind of sensitivity to your body and your connection to things. And the imagination it takes is not a fantasy, but the imagination that listens to the body and tries to let it come forth more. What Coleridge said, poets really have to do. I want to talk about, because I'm going to stop in 5 minutes. I want to talk about the painful side of embodiment, though. So if we have a history, and we certainly do in all cultures, unfortunately, of violence and people violating each other and inflicting pain upon each other, it's only the natural reaction to flee from that, to protect oneself. The image I can never get out of my mind, I must have read Toni Morrison's Beloved, I don't know, like first time decades ago. But there's a character there, Paul D, who's been whipped and whipped and whipped as a slave and humiliated and tortured in all these ways. And he says, saying more might push them to a place that they couldn't get back from. He would keep the rest where it belonged, in that tobacco tin buried in his chest, where a red heart used to be, its lid is rusted shut. I mean, we can all put our feelings in a tin, and we can all retreat from the body and from really inhabiting it and really letting ourselves go into our senses. And it's the only sensible thing to do if you're being hurt. And what the Buddhists would say and the phenomenologists would say, that creates a vicious cycle, right? Because the more you retreat from the world in that way because you've been hurt, the more likely you are to hurt other people. Because that's what it takes to hurt other people, right? I mean, one of my favorite examples from Man's Search for Meaning by Viktor Frankl is, you know, the SS troops, the Nazi troops who did these horrible tortures to other human beings, they had an unlimited budget for alcohol because the only way they could do it is to get so drunk that they blotted out their feelings and then you can do these horrible things to other people. So it's not an easy thing to come back from that. And it takes a lot of courage. And I understand that. And I'll talk later, during my last comments about how some exercises that might help people with that. But I want to say also that just a word or two about ethics before I end. So ethics, I teach it all the time. I taught it like 33 times, I think. And the way ethics is taught is all these rules, you know, rules from God, rules from reason, the social contract, you know, endless rules, rules, rules. And I'm sorry, I don't think rules help people to really be ethical with one another. I think what I call it's the only ethics that really makes sense to me is the ethics of felt solidarity. When you feel, when you're open to feeling another person, and then that allows you to get into their world, because I do think that the body opens worlds for us. When you can feel another person's world, then, you know, the Buddhists would say spontaneously there's right action. You don't have to like think of a rule. And then, you know, then the rules might make more sense actually. So one of my favorite novels, Saint-Exupéry wrote this novel, Flight to Arras is what it's translated as in English. And he's flying these missions in the beginning of the war, and they're suicide missions. And he doesn't know why he's doing it. And he feels like I'm following all these empty rules, and he's flying over the people and he's disconnected from them. And then he flies into this German anti-aircraft nest over Arras, and they take all this heavy fire, and they all assume they're gonna die, but they didn't tell them they had an experimental fuel tank that just absorbed all the bullets the way the tires absorb our nails now. And so they come back and they can't believe it. And he just is transformed. All of a sudden he feels and he's in his body in a different way. And then he said, now those ethical rules make sense to me now that I feel my connection to other people. I mean, I'm glad we have those ethical rules because for cultures that are totally alienated, I call it the ethics of last resort. At least those rules might stop them if they can't feel what they're doing to other people. But it's not, I think, the basis for the world I'd like to live in. All right. And I promise I'm going to stop in 60 more seconds. But one last story. So Arne Naess is the father of deep ecology. And Arne Naess wrote an essay a long time ago about how disappointed he was. He took all of his favorite students up to his mountaintop little hut, and there was these beautiful wildflowers. And he told them to go out and commune with them and come back and talk about it and to write something about it. And none of them felt any connection to it at all. And so I wrote a response to him that said, you know, if you had them go out there and instead of like write scientific things or write in there, if you had them try to be write poetry, you might have had a different experience. Because, you know, those are, I mean, for me, the poetry and the philosophy are connected. that we use language in such a way that it's like we're just putting things in boxes and we're not really experiencing them. And that poetry is about using words in a totally different way, you know, breaking down language and somehow getting thrown back into your experience. I mean, to write a poem, you don't just think about your vocabulary and your ideas. You have to feel what you felt and go back to your experience. And you're not going to put it in a poem unless you somehow break out of all those old categories. And so that's what I've had the experience. If I send my students out there into those wildflower fields and tell them, talk about it in a way you never did before, you know, try to do a metaphor. Because what's a metaphor? A metaphor connects things that we don't think go together, but somehow you find a connection between them. I mean, to me, that's what we have to do in order to open up this wonder world again. And there's a lot more things I had to say, but I want to stop and get the questions. I'm going to stop now and open it to questions, and maybe I can say some more things.
Thank you so much, Glenn. If anyone has any questions yet, please type them in the Q&A box. We do have one question that's already come in, which is, what's the first step towards embodiment for newbies?
What's the first step to embodiment for newbies? Is that right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, okay. That's almost the question that Mike said he was going to ask me at the end.
Yeah, we'll bring it forward.
Okay, we'll bring it forward.
So, I have many other questions to ask.
Well, I have had this privilege, you know, of I just lucked out and, you know, because there's not too many, at that time, there weren't too many Zen groups in the country. And I've really found Zen to be helpful, you know, that because part of what stops us from experiencing our body is this kind of like Thich Nhat Hanh would call it, like we have these little radios blaring in our minds, you know, with this thought, that thought, this thought, that thought. So, you know, the easiest thing is just, you know, get a line your back up. And so that you're not straining like in a West Point soldier kind of way, but you're letting your shoulders down, your belly hang out, which is why the Buddha had a big belly, by the way. It's not because he snacked all the time. It's because he relaxed his belly and let it hang out. But I promise you won't get a Buddha belly from doing this for 5 minutes. And breathing deeply a couple times and exhaling. At first, just do it artificially deeply. And then what the Buddhists would have you do, or the Zen Buddhists in particular, and then also plant your feet. You can do all these fancy lotus positions, but you can just do it sitting on the edge of a chair too. If you really plant your feet so you actually feel the floor or the ground beneath you, which a lot of times we don't. And so you're sort of totally relaxed in your back and you're letting your spine, if you go around, it'll like line up and just the vertebrae will just like stack up on each other naturally without you stressing about it. And then follow your breath all the way down, and not to your lungs, but the Buddhists would say your breath goes all the way down to your haren, or your hara is dantian. There's different names for it in different languages. Feminists talk about the solar plexus. So, about four fingers below your belly button, sort of inside. Let your breath go all the way down and then let it go all the way out and just follow it. And you're going to find that after a while, it just naturally slows down and becomes deep. And then, you know, you can cheat, but I don't like cheating. But if you want to cheat, you can count one, and then two when it comes out, and three and four, and start again at 10, because that's a trick. Because if you realize you're up to 37, you haven't been paying attention. Or if you realize you're not counting anymore, you haven't been paying attention. But really, the real exercise is just to follow your breath in and out when you don't use the trick. And then you might find that when you stop that, like if you do it even just for 5 or 10 minutes a day, you might look around and suddenly go, wow, like the colors are brighter. Oh yeah, like, you know, I'm feeling, I'm smelling things, I'm noticing things I didn't even notice before. So, I mean, that's one of many things. I still have some more exercises to tell you later. Although I'm tempted to give you one more. I'll give you one more. And that is, well, you can't see me, but if you, this is the one my students found the most helpful. I take them on an hour and a half meditative walk, and I have all these exercises that are part of it. But usually the exercises only work when they do this one Buddhist thing, which is walk as slowly as possible. Raise your foot so slow, and then down, and pay total attention to it. And if you walk that way for about 5 minutes, that's what my students really found. They said, wow, it's like somebody woke me up. All of a sudden I was here in a different way. So those are two exercises I'll give you.
Yeah, I love both of those. I also really love this question from Donna, which was going back to what you were touching on about the pain of embodiment or pain of coming back to the body, which is, she asks, could you talk about the blocks we have to embodiment?
And in what way do you want me to talk about the blocks?
Well, I suppose what they mean is you talked about the pain, you know, leading to a disembodied process.
Yes. I get it. So I think what makes us retreat from our bodies and from these feelings and from, I think the world itself is a whole before we kind of tear it apart. It's not a whole in the sense it's one, but it's a whole in the sense that everything is interconnected. I mean, we're all unique individuals and everything around us is unique, but they're all also interconnected at the same time. And what makes us kind of cut those connections is the pain that we felt. But it's interesting because hurt and pain, I once looked at the etymologies of them, and hurt, its etymology is about showing you where you are connected. And pain is kind of, you know, connected to pain, bread, and it's about nourishment. And I think, you know, that when you start coming back to the body, like I've said earlier, you know, that everything that's happened to us and everything that's happened in our culture even is still with us in some shape or form. And if it's something very important that's happened to hurt you, that's very much still with you. And so when you come back to the world, I mean, why did Paul D want to stay in a tin can, have his heart be a tin can, which, by the way, he gets beyond in the end of the book. Why did he want to do that? Because opening up again means you're going to start having to go through some of that pain, because, you know, all the feelings are interconnected. But it's a different thing to feel that pain while you are opening yourself to all these interconnections, because, you know, that's, I think, the Buddhist point, is that it's when we feel like we're alone and we don't reach out to not just other people, but the natural world, to the things around us. I mean, they all have healing properties insofar as we open them. So it's like, I'll give a fiction, and I want to use a real case study. I'll use a fictional one like Teo. You know, Teo, if you were to read Ceremony, I mean, he has to go through a lot of zones of pain. But, you know, whether it's dragonflies, whether it's the mountains, whether it's some of the incredible people that he meets on this journey of healing, they help him feel the pain in a way that's not overbearing, that's not annihilating, in a way that he has helped to move through that to a different kind of openness. I don't think it's something, there's this cult of autonomy and self-sufficiency, which really plagues males. We didn't get into gender issues. But one of my books is about reconnecting men to earth, because I think it's particularly problematic for men because we're raised to be these autonomous, self-sufficient individuals. But, this is another thing about phenomenology, Buddhism, Gestalt tries to show us that we're, the we is older than the I. We're more interconnected with people. How do we find out who we are? It's through other people. How do we keep growing who we are? It's through interacting with other people. But then I think something that the Native Americans, the Buddhists, and the phenomenologists add also is it's through interacting with the world itself, ecologically. Last year I spoke with Dave Abrams, and he's always talking about the more than human world. Rivers have been given selfhood by a certain couple, like in Nepal and some other places around the world. Things have their own identity and they gesture to us, and some of their gesturing is very healing. I can't keep my sanity right now during this crazy time in America with all this hatred and violence and the pandemic. If I didn't run every day along the path that goes by the river through the woods, because they speak to me and they give me something that can help me get through this time. And that's, I guess, another thing I want to say about dealing with pain and with newbies to embodiment that fits for both of them, is that the world is always moving. It's changing, transforming. We want to hold on and stop it. And philosophy is mainly incorrect because it looks at little slices of things instead of their whole evolving, changing existence. And so you have to move, even if you're disabled and you can only move a finger, you got to move, you got to keep moving. And, I don't just write about the body, I have to run every day. I have to do things every day with my body to sink it into the world. I'm probably not the best person to ask about going through those stages of pain because, I couldn't decide whether to be a therapist or a philosopher or a poet, and I chose philosopher. I mean, my wife, the therapist, would probably have some better exercises about dealing with the pain, but that's some answer.
Yeah, fascinating. And you're getting a lot of love in the chat here. So many people are saying, thank you, thank you. It's been really enlightening, all those sorts of things. And I am just noting the time. So we do have a bit less than 10 minutes left, and we do have a few more questions coming in. Did you want to take a few more questions, or did you have some discussion points you wanted to throw back at us?
I would rather take questions. I have other things to say, but I'd rather have questions. Go ahead.
Yeah. Okay. So the next question coming in from Neil, which is, as you're perceiving the world through your senses, how much do you allow in the thoughts that may follow from that immediate sensory experience?
Thank you. Great question. I don't want to say that part of us, a very valuable part of us, it'd be kind of crazy as a philosopher for me to paint all thinking as evil since I've spent my whole life thinking. It's when we set our thinking at odds with our feeling that there's a problem. Some people take that as a given, that my thinking is always going to be at odds with my feeling. And I would say just the opposite. If your thinking's at odds with your feeling, there's something you haven't worked out yet. Why would I even give this lecture? Why would I, read poetry, read philosophy? Because it can help you get back to the feeling if it somehow synchronizes with it, if it points you back in a direction that's helpful. So yeah. So I mean, if you have sensory experiences that give you thoughts that help you, oh yeah, now I see that. Boy, I can really even go further, you know, with this experience. Or, oh, you know, maybe that experience opens up a connection to this. Like, you know, the way I felt this might sound crazy, but one of the things that my students do is like dance with trees and things, you know? So if you dance with the tree, you might suddenly realize, oh, you know, maybe I could dance with the person I've been shy with, or, you know, I mean, so thinking is very helpful, yes, to furthering this process. It's just when somehow your thinking tells you to retreat from your feeling or to negate your feeling or to not pay attention to your feeling or says that all feeling is, you know, incorrect, then there's something wrong with the thought or the feeling or something's gone wrong there. But the more deeper you get into things, because that's what Merleau-Ponty, I mean, that's what I love about Merleau-Ponty. He keeps saying there's always more meaning. There's always more stuff to get into in any of your experience. Like he sees a red dress and he like lets his, he says, you know, if I were really to feel all that I feel at this moment, this red dress reminds me of the violence of the Russian Revolution. It reminds me of the gypsies who I saw in these red dresses. It reminds me of professors. It reminds me, and he goes on and on for like pages. And he's saying that like, and he's using his mind there, but he's going into the depths of his feeling. And he's saying, there's always more meaning we can get out of the world, you know? And so when you go deeper, then things come together more. It's like only short circuit that spiraling that then things end up opposed. I don't want to go on and on. I want more questions, sorry.
And we have time for probably two more questions. The next question is, what's your top tip for when anger emerges?
So, yeah, so anger is a tough feeling to deal with, right? And actually, biographically, I had a very, very angry father, and it was probably my biggest challenge too. So I think anger has to be expressed, and it has to be befriended, because just what I'm saying, if you try to just suppress it, it's, you know, you're just going to have headaches or stomach aches, and it's going to come out anyhow in some indirect and unfortunate way. So anger has to be expressed. So I think you have to find a way to channel it so that it's constructive, so that it's more about what you feel. I mean, like, anger always leads to you statements. This is, and now you're getting a gestalt wisdom here. Instead of saying you are this and that is that, I feel this and I feel that, you know, because underneath the anger is always hurt. And, you know, if you can get to the hurt part and just talk from your own self, then it leads you forward to something else. But I have to say, okay, my wife Judith is gonna watch this tape later. My wife Judith has taught me that sometimes I need to walk away for 10 minutes. I live by a train, by the way. Sometimes I have to walk away for 10 minutes and, yeah, commune with the tree or commune with the river or whatever, and then come back. And then I'm not so overloaded with the anger. And then I can express, okay, you know, it made me angry because I'm hurt about this. And because I'm really feeling that, and then you can enter a dialogue. I don't want to go on because I want to get another question.
Yes, and useful practical tips there too. Yes, we are out of time, but I'm going to squeeze this question in because I'm also very curious about what you might respond it with. And the question is from Alessandro, and they ask, how could you speak about the creative process with your poetry and the relation with embodiment? From where does it come in to your practice as being a poet?
I guess I feel like it's all about my body, my poetry. The creative process to me is somehow no longer trying to be in charge of myself and where I'm going, but just letting the world speak back to me. And, you know, when I was saying, listening to the voices of silence, I think the voices of silence, the gesturing of the world, the stuff that's somehow submerged and not on the surface and wants to come out, you know, that takes a somehow stilling oneself and opening oneself through the body, and then a different kind of creativity comes through. I mean, if I try to think myself to a poem, it's going to be horrible. It's like I never know where a poem's going. Like, you know, I start it and I have an idea. Oh, this is a big, great poem. And then it goes in some totally different direction. And I think it's about rhythm. You know, I didn't get to talk about rhythm during my talk. So much of what I've talked about here is about rhythm. Because when you connect to the world, you start getting rhythms from different parts of the world, because that's one of the ways the world speaks to us. You know, the river has a different rhythm. The still mountain has a different rhythm. And I think that's one of the things that happens in the poetic creative process, is you start opening to all those rhythms, and those rhythms are kind of gestures, and those gestures give you words I would have never thought of, or ideas or images I would have never thought of. And I could say more, but I know we're out of time.
Yeah, I feel like we're just scratching the surface.
I know.
But if anybody would like to continue the conversation, that's what the coffee break rooms are for. So if you all head into your the portal where the website is, there are coffee break rooms where you can meet other attendees and continue these sorts of conversations. And we'll post a link to that in the chat. Glenn, I'll come back to you in just one second, but just to everyone else who's attending, if you have been interested in this talk, do remember you have access to it for 48 hours for free. However, if you would like to upgrade and purchase the entire conference, because there are 6 other channels going right now where you're not attending, and if you would like to get everything, then the conference is half price until the end of the conference. So we'll put a link, we've just put a link in the chat there for that if you would wish to upgrade. And also, if you're a trauma therapist, there are discounts for you as well. The next speaker that we have coming up is Dr. Alistair McIntosh, looking at embodying community. And then before we go, Glenn, just back to you, just final words, leaving comments, anything left unsaid on embodiments in the body and your process?
Because this is an ecology section, I think I'm going to quote Nietzsche, who said, every atom affects every atom in the whole of the universe. And there's only dynamic quanta processes in relation to all the other ones. So I'm going to say that, you know, our bodies are inseparable from the world around us, the ecological, the lives around us, the plants around us, the creatures, the rocks, even the mountains. I wrote an article about how painful it is to see those mountaintop mining sites. And so that, you know, that every time we don't care lovingly and sensitively for the world around us, the other creatures, and even the inanimate things of nature, and even our own creations, we lose a part of ourselves, and it's hurting ourselves. That's what I'm going to say is my final thought.